This is part two of a three-part interview. Was conducted at Naval Air Station Miramar, San Diego, California, on 22 March 1974. The interviewer is Captain R.A. Bowling, United States Navy retired, graduate student at San Diego State University.
Yeah, Lieutenant, we left off. You were on your way home. Would you pick it up from there, please?
Okay, I just come back to the United States on a magic carpet flight, drove out to Missouri, and I was watching television when I noticed that the North Vietnamese had, in fact, staged its major invasion around Easter time. They call it the Easter Invasion. And I looked up and told my parents, I said, the Constellation is in Japan, and I'm home, but I just imagine if there's a major invasion that the Constellation is going to be recalled. 1 hour later, I'd been home a total of 6 hours. I received a call from our executive officer, who was Commander Dwight Timm, saying that, he said, Duke, well, Duke is my nickname, and I use that call sign whenever I flew. He said, Duke, we've got to go back overseas. And at that time, I thought my parents were going to disown the service. And I made my way back to the ship after another long drive. It took me a couple days to get back. Came back aboard the ship, and we were the ship, the Constellation, was now operating down around Anlock, which is just north of Saigon. What had happened, there was a major invasion on about three or four different fronts. The North Vietnamese were attacking Quang Tri City. They were making minute probes around Da Nang. They were hitting Anlock, and then down farther south they were making. But the biggest push right now was the city of Anlock itself.
That's in the Central Highlands, isn't it?
I don't know what you call the Central Highlands. It's just north of Saigon, about 70 miles.
It's not the Central Highlands. All right, I know where you are now. All right.
For the first time, we had major targets, and for quite a few years, we'd been bombing trucks. Now, every once in a while, you can see a truck and bomb it or something like this, but these were large targets. This is like a million-gallon oil drum that the North Vietnamese had taken over, or these are big houses and fortifications and tanks and things like this. They were large targets that you could actually get you could see what you were bombing for a change. They were out in the open, troops and the rest of it. I remember rolling in and dropping on a like you see in these Gulf Atomic oil things that, you know, are about 200, 300 feet wide, and dropped a 500-pounder on it, and I thought we'd just gone all the way through Hades. The flame went up, you know, a couple thousand feet in the air, and it's targets like we'd never had. We even had to bomb some of our own ammunition that the North Vietnamese had overrun the South Vietnamese and taken over, and we didn't want them to keep their hands on it. Going right down Anlock's runway were two enemy VC tanks that were making a run on Anlock, and I rolled in and dropped some rock-eye bombs on those. And it's the first time I'd ever bombed a tank. It's, you know, one stop, two tanks. The targets like that, you feel like you're doing something worthwhile than bombing trees or expending on trucks. Well, very shortly thereafter, they started making what we call alpha strikes into the north. We had 3 to 4 carriers over there, and an alpha strike is where you send like 30 or 40 airplanes off a carrier and hit a target, say like a railroad yard or storage area or a bridge or a thermonuclear plant or military supply area, things like this. We started conducting alpha strikes up above the 19th parallel, and this is right in the heart of the north, and where the enemy were. We knew by doing this that we were going to lose a lot of people, because this is where the SAMs, the AAA, and most of it is located. However, I don't believe the North Vietnamese ever expected us to go back into the North, because a great majority of their guns and stuff were moved down into Laos, supporting the Ho Chi Minh Trail. We hit some targets that in 1966, 67, the people that bombed the North bombed the areas in the southern part of the North, really got clobbered. Well, we went in there and didn't receive any fire, because you could see the empty gun emplacements. They had taken those guns out and moved them down south, figuring, I guess, that we'd never come back. Well, that wasn't true in a lot of areas. We hit one area, and on 8 May, we were assigned to hit a target. It was a 3-carrier strike. Each carrier sent in about 30 to 35 airplanes on a major target. I think it was a Kitty Hawk that sent in the first strike, and the Constellation sent in the second wave, and then I believe it was a Coral Sea over there at the time that sent in another wave. Well, on 8 May, Brian Grant and myself, and Willie was in my back seat, we were assigned MGCAP on a strike group, again to protect the strike group from MiGs attacking MiGs. We got a call from Red Crown, who is a picket ship in the Gulf of Tonkin that has a radar coverage of the north, and they give us GCI vectors toward bandits. Well, they came up and said, showtime, and that's our squadron call sign, showtime. They said, showtime, you've got a bandit unknown altitude about 350 at 40 miles. They said, your vector is 350 for bandit. So we started out and headed toward him when it dawned on me it was just about time for the strike group to get out over the target. Now, you can go chasing MiGs anywhere you want, but if our job is to keep the MiGs off of the strike group, not to go out in a blaze of glory and just kill MiGs. We've got a definite purpose in our mission. So I turned the section around rather than chasing after a MiG. It could be just a trick that they use to lure the fighters off the attack airplane. Turned the section back around, started back, flew over the target area. Our airplanes had just started to roll in, and Red Crown came up and said, you've got MiGs coming in at about 20 miles. Now, that's pretty close. It doesn't take a supersonic MiG to go very far. You figure he's doing 10 miles a minute, a little bit better than that. He's almost a minute, minute and a half away from you. If you turn your nose to him, it's a minute. And so I turned the section back around, headed north after the MiGs that were coming down, the GCI. We couldn't get a radar lock on them. Again, they were down in the weeds, very low. There was an overcast that was real hard to see down through. If you were below it, you could look up. The sky was clear, but it was hard to look down and see the ground. Well, I was losing my radios with Red Crown. They were quite a ways away, being clear in the Gulf of Tonkin. And my wingman, Brian Grant, came up and says, Duke, come port, in place port, which means we both turn port at the same time. And we're about a mile apart of each other, parallel to each other, a beam. Well, I turned port, and on another occasion, in that type of turn, we lost an F-4 in a turn. The trail man coming out of the turn was blown up. He was hit by an Atoll missile shot from a MiG-21. Well, I thought, we're in an area of MiGs. We don't have a radar contact. My radios are acting up. So I split. I went to full afterburner, drove my nose almost straight up over the flight, over my wingman, and looked down. And just as soon as I looked down, I saw a MiG-17 at 6 o'clock, or about 7 o'clock, shooting guns at him. He was in about 2,000 feet. I told Brian, I said, Brian, you got a MiG-17, 7 o'clock. Get ready your centerline tank, unload, and go. Well, he did accelerate. The F-4 out-accelerates a MiG-17. It can't out-turn it, but it can out-accelerate it. Brian accelerated, and just about the time that he got out of gun range on the MiG, he shot a heat-seeking missile at him. Well, I called Brian to brake. It defeated the missile. But by turning back in toward the MiG was able to rendezvous on him or close on him from the inside of his turn. Well, started down, got my nose put on the MiG, and just then Willie said, Duke, look up. And we had two MiG-17s pass about 100 feet above our canopy, right over the top of us. And to tell you how they turned, they were parallel to each other, a beam of each other, and they turned inside of each other. Came right down at our 6 o'clock. Now, we've got two MiGs back about 2 miles behind us at our 6 o'clock. Brian's out in front of another MiG that's chasing and shooting him. Brian had started to unload to get away from this guy again. He was using a maneuver that we use, a disengagement maneuver, which I can't go into, from the MiG-17. He started to walk away, and I had about 60 degrees to go to the tail of this MiG, where you have to get in a cone somewhere around 30 degrees to be able to shoot a sidewinder or shoot a missile. It's like an old style. You have to get in a gun kill range just beyond it to shoot a missile. Well, the MiGs, by Brian turning, allowed the MiGs to close on me as well. So they were closing into gun range. They also had missiles on them, and we knew it. Now, the job of the RAO in this situation is I say, okay, Willie, I'm padlocked, which means I've got sight on the MiG ahead of us. You turn aft and look and let me know how the MiGs behind us are doing. If they start pulling lead that they need to kill us with their gun, let me know. I said, fine. I had about 50 degrees to go and fired a missile intentionally. A missile won't kill a MiG then, but what it did, it forced him to break off my wingman. He saw the missile coming. He had to turn into it to defeat it. The missile went on by him, and it reversed. Well, as he reversed, I squeezed a trigger and put a sidewinder into him. Well, he blew up. I told Brian to pitch up high, that I was pulling to the low into the inside of his turn, and my intention was to fly down below Brian, pull the MiGs, or drag them in front of him, and then he could roll in and take the MiGs off my tail. Well, I rolled left, and I got tracers coming over the canopy. Well, I said, I can't go that way. They're pulling lead, so I rolled right. And when I rolled right, I got tracers over the right canopy because the MiGs had stationed themselves on either side of me. And no matter which way I rolled, that one shot. Okay, if I'd go up in that position, I only had about 420 knots on the airplane trying to get in for Brian's MiG. If I'd go up, the MiG would have rendezvoused on me and closed to inside 1,000 feet, and I would have probably been killed. So the only thing I had left is I took the nose, snapped full rudder, snapped pull back, put 12 G's on the airplane. When the airplane came back, it had rivets pulled out of the wing panels. It had broke both flap hinges, grayed us out in the pull, and a MiG-17 with a superior turn radius rendezvoused on us. And here I am sitting looking about the height away from a ceiling, looking at two Atoll missiles, and I could read his bureau number on the side of his airplane at the belly. So I pushed over, went into the clouds. Okay, I hadn't used afterburner at that time because if you use burner, that missile that they shoot has got a bigger heat source. Yeah. Okay, the clouds disperse an IR source. So if you've got an afterburner lit and you're in clouds, the missile can't see that heat source. So for the first time, I could go into burner. I lit burner, told Brian that I was just going to accelerate out to about 600 knots, which a MiG-17 can't go that fast at that low altitude because he's got control problems in it. And this is part of knowing what your enemy's airplane can do. Well, Brian said he was losing sight, and I said, that's great, because so are they. I asked Brian, I said, Brian, do you see where the sun is? And he said, yep. So I said, I'm going right for the sun. Now, when I go for the sun, if they'd shoot an Atoll at me, I'd go idle, boards, break down into them, and the missiles would go for the sun, the heat source of the sun. This is another tactic you can use. And as soon as I came up, heading for the sun, the MiGs came up after me, Brian rolled in on them, and they broke off. A few minutes later, two Air Force birds killed two MiG-17s heading back up to Yen Bai airfield. We don't know if it's the same two or not. Again, we went back aboard the ship. At this time, it made Willie and I the leading MiG killers in Southeast Asia. At that time, we went had a word from Saigon. Up
did
to
you get any that day? You didn't get any that day, did you?
Yeah, that was my second kill. The MiG that was on my wingman's tail, I fired and shot a sidewinder at him and killed him.
Oh, okay.
And then right after he blew up is when I started to turn for the other MiGs. Yeah. No, I had to get the MiG off of his tail. He was going to die.
You shot him off.
Shot him off my wingman's tail.
You shot one at him, that caused him to break the first time.
Then I fired a second missile, which hit him and blew him up. Okay, and then I tried to disengage from the two that were chasing me. Okay.
Well, I believe that Lieutenant Driscoll said something about this might have been a trap, or it was indicated that on that day you first spotted two 19s coming, and they went by, and when you turned on them, then up came these other four. Did you see two 19s the same day?
No, I didn't.
That was a different incident.
That was a different incident.
Oh, well, you remember that incident, though.
Not with us. The commanding officer, Ron McEwen, here at the school, had that particular incident.
My mistake. Okay, that's why I was talking to Lieutenant Commander Ench. That was that. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. No, we didn't engage any 19s on this day.
That was their incident. Thank you for correcting the record. Please go ahead.
Okay. Again, we went back to the ship and found out that the North Vietnamese had been trying to set traps for Willie and myself. This made us the leading MiG killers, and like any country has a Red Baron, granted two kills aren't very much, but they had tried to set traps. They monitor our radios, transmissions, They knew what my call sign was, and it's, the one that's across my flight suit right now, Duke. And whenever Duke flight would check in, they'd vector MiGs or try and knock us down with SAMs, and they could use that politically against us in Saigon, just as we came back as aces, and the Navy used us, exploited us for public relations. They could also do the same thing, just like they did the dikes, the mining of the harbors, and the rest of it. Well, I figured myself, I said, well, I'm out there. My job is to kill MiGs. And if I use my call sign and they send more MiGs about me, that guys just die trying to get a chance to see one of them. So I figured if I use my call sign, maybe I'll get a chance to see them. So I told them no, and I kept my same call sign as Duke. Well, we went along, and 2 days later, the schedule came out, and they were having a large strike, the deepest end of the north that the Navy had ever gone, up around Hanoi, at least in this time period of 1972. And it was a strike on Hai Duong Railroad Yard, a railroad yard that led into one of these passes directly from Hanoi, and where the supplies were going down. Well, my name wasn't on the schedule at first, and I was upset because I thought there'd be a good chance for MiGs to be around. And understand, you know, people are afraid of going on strikes, and they really don't like to get shot at. But we're highly trained pilots, and when there's a chance at a MiG's flying, a fighter pilot will jump at the chance to go on that mission, even though he knows he's going to get shot at, probably. Well, I was disappointed because I wasn't going on that mission. And all of a sudden they said, well, we need two F-4s to carry Rockeye bombs and as flak suppressors. And what a flak suppressor does, a Phantom is faster than the A-7 or the A-6s, and if a gun's shooting at the A-6s, we roll in at a lot faster speeds and knock out the guns. And then when we pitch off target, we've got Sparrow and Sidewinder, and we can also become a fighter after that. But our primary mission is to stop any guns that are shooting at the attack airplanes while they're hitting the target. Well, we launched out toward Hai Duong, and I learned later that we expected to lose three or four airplanes, that was expendable. It is lucky it didn't turn out quite that much. But the A-6s flew by one railroad yard, which happened to be the target, and they started rolling in. Well, they made a mistake. I looked down, and the A-6s rolled in from north to south. The A-7s rolled in from north to south. Some more A-7s rolled in to north to south, and they looked like a column of ants going down in a stream. And you don't do that even in Laos where there aren't guns. And here they were shooting 85 and 100 millimeter guns at us. SAMs were whizzing through the air. And what it does for a gunner, it gives him a direct plot. And somebody in that line is going to get bagged. Well, sure enough, Commander Blackburn flew around, who is in our sister squadron, VF-92, and he had Steve Rudloff in his back seat. His wingman was pretty tight on his wing. And just as they got to the point where the other planes would start to roll in, they were hit by 85-millimeter gun. Commander Blackburn's plane exploded like a pumpkin hit by a magnum shell. I didn't think anybody could live out of it. It was just a fireball, and all of a sudden two chutes appeared. Commander Blackburn never came back when the POWs did. Steve Rudloff did come back. He was held as a POW until his release later in 1973. His wingman went out, single engine, with a damaged F-4, and two MiG-21s rolled in on him and then disengaged for some reason. And he was going out single engine on fire, which he was pretty worried about that. He had a pretty good chance of going down himself. Well, we rolled in and hit our target. As we pitched off, Brian Grant again with me, who had been along with me on two other MiG kills, hadn't got a chance to shoot a MiG yet. Well, Brian rolled in on right behind me, and as we pitched off target, he called out, Duke, you got two MiG-17s at 7 o'clock. Well, I had made a mistake. I was looking at the target that I just bombed in a starboard turn, and I shouldn't have been doing that. I wasn't thinking about MiGs. I was looking at a target, and it was wrong. It's a mistake. Well, I reversed back port, saw two MiG-17s slashing in with their guns already going, closing in inside a gun range. I don't know why they didn't hit me. I could see tracers flying by the canopy. You can see the 23-millimeter winking out of the wings, and a big 37-millimeter, it looks like a blowtorch coming out of there every time it shoots. It's a slow-fire cannon, and he was sitting right where you have to be to kill somebody. My first thought was to break into him. Well, I didn't break into him. I thought, I did this 2 days ago and a MiG-17 rendezvoused on me. But I looked again, and he really had a lot of closure. He was just hauling. So I broke down into him. He overshot my flight path. As I reversed, his wingman split up over the top of us. As he shot past me, I reversed my course, put my nose on his tailpipe. He was at about 1,000 feet ahead of me, opening by about 50 knots. I squeezed the trigger. The winder went off, hit him, blew him up, and just as I pitched back up, the second MiG rolled in on me. My wingman says, "Duke, you got one coming in at you again?" I said, "Fine." I used a disengagement maneuver, got away from that MiG-17, looked back at Brian and said, "Brian, I'll drag this one for you." And that morning, I said, "Brian, if we see a MiG, I'll drag one for you."
So what do you mean by dragging one?
Well, with a MiG behind you, you've got more acceleration than he does. You can hold him angles off where he can't shoot you with his missile, and you can hold him pretty stable in one position if he stays there while your wingman comes around and shoots him. Well, I look Brian, and Brian says, "Duke, I can't." I look back, and he had 2 17s on him, and a MiG-21's passing overhead. We accelerated out. Brian got rid of the disengage from the two MiGs that were on him, and he came up beside me, and I hadn't seen him at the time, and I looked over at my 9 o'clock, and there was Brian sitting on the wing, and he says, "Hi, Duke." He said, "Let's go." So we said, "Fine." We're back there, and there's more MiGs than we'd ever dreamed of back there, so we pitched up in the vertical, went above about 20,000 feet, and looked down below us, and there were 8 MiG-17s in a defensive wheel, just like it looked like a wagon wheel, flying a circle. And what they do is they fly in a circle. If somebody gets behind them, the guy behind him shoots the guy in front of him. Well, I told Blaine, the flight leader, I said, "Brian, cover me. I'm in." Went down and with the intention of catching one on the belly side and getting off a missile, when all of a sudden an F-4 passed in front, almost hit it, missed it about 50, didn't even see him coming. Flew right in front of me, just his jet wash almost tore our airplane apart. Went passed through, and I said, "Willie, who's in 112? Which is aircraft number 112. We passed that close to him, and he said the XO, and I said, "Great God," because he had a MiG-17. He was in a port turn with a MiG-17 at about 3,000 feet behind him shooting. He had a MiG-21 at about 3,500 feet tracking the inside, and what he didn't see was another MiG-17 about 300 feet flying wing on him to his belly side that he couldn't see. We rolled in and tried to get a tone on the MiG. Well, he was an afterburner. The MiG was so close to him that when I put my gun sight on the MiG, I didn't get any tone differential, which means if I'd shoot a sidewinder, it would probably hit the Phantom instead of the MiG being a bigger heat source. So the Phantom accelerated out, tried to get him to reverse starboard, and he thought I was talking about the other MiG. It's one problem you have with that many airplanes. You don't know really who's in the other airplane, except in this case it did. We started, and out of this defensive wheel, by him turning port, or left, out of this wheel, we had 4 17s tracking behind us. And all of a sudden, I noticed tracers coming over my canopy again. And here I'm trying to knock down a MiG ahead of us. And here's the game again. I'm sitting looking ahead of the MiG ahead of me, and I've trained the row in my back seat. I know that he knows when a MiG is in a lethal range. Just because a MiG has his nose on you doesn't mean he's got an advantage, but doesn't mean he can kill you. He has to put his nose, say like for guns, he's got a pull lead on you if you've got G. And unless he has that lead, he can't kill you. So I told Willie, I said, "Willie, tell me when he's got lead." Okay, so I accelerated after the MiG ahead of me. The XO was in a port turn, which was a mistake, allowed those MiGs to stay in position on me. Just started to squeeze off a missile when I looked up, and at 2 o'clock, I saw flashes above me. And I thought, God, there can't be any more MiGs in the air. They brought 100 of the damn little things. And what happened, I thought, there's 2 more 17s. I said, "Willie, there's 2 17s making a run on us," and they pulled up above us, and they weren't 17s, they were MiG-19s. They pulled up above us, rolled over the top to the outside of our circle, so I unloaded. They came back around, buried their nose into us, made about 120 degree deflection shot again, and this time I broke up into them, and I was doing about 600 knots now. Broke up into them, rolled over the top, and back onto the 17 behind the XO. I said, "XO, reverse your airplane or you're going to die. He reversed starboard. The MiG reversed. I got tone, no tone, a tone on the MiG-17, squeezed, and the missile hit the MiG-17. Oh, before this, just before the MiG-19s made their second run, we looked up and there were four MiG-21s about 3,000 feet above us.
So we had 17s,
19s, and 21s. There's 22 MiGs in our airspace. And they weren't rolling. I just guessed they didn't want to get down in all those BBs that were whizzing by. It's the only reason I figured. Well, when this guy blew up, Jim Fox was in the XO's back seat, and they didn't know the MiG was there yet. He reversed starboard, took a look, and here he was, MiG-17 flying wing on him, right beside him out here, about 300 feet away from him. Just as he reversed, he saw the little Gomer, as we call him, little North Vietnamese, looking out at him. And then the next thing he saw was a missile travel the entire length of the airplane and just blew him up. And the next thing was the North Vietnamese ejected right beside him. Said that picture will flash in his mind for the rest of his life. At that time, the MiG-21s rolled in on us. I broke up into the MiG-21s. They overshot my flight path, reversed port to keep an eye on them, and then just said, Willie, we're getting the hell out of here. I didn't see it. The only other MiG, F-4 I saw was the XOs by that time. Brian was taking care of his own MiGs at that time. Steve Shoemaker, who was in VF-96, our squadron, got a MiG that day. Matt Connolly and Tom Blonsky, his backseater, they got two MiGs the same day. So our squadron, we got six MiGs that day.
And you got one?
I got three this day. That was the second kill right there. I just took off the XO's tail. The first one is the MiG overshot. The second one is off the XO's tail, and now I'm trying to get out and just get feet wet, which means out over the Gulf of Tonkin where nobody can shoot at us. There's no MiGs. It's like King's X. You're safe. So we're on our way out, and I see a little pinhead out there of an airplane, some relative motion, and I said, Willie, we got another plane on the nose. I don't see anybody else right now. And all of a sudden, I look up, and it's a MiG-17. Well, you fight like you train, and back against the fighter weapons school, I'd always tried to meet the A-4 as close as I could to take out all lateral separation so he couldn't gain any turn advantage on me. Well, an A-4 doesn't shoot back out here in Whiskey 291 in training. I tried to meet this guy head-on, and all of a sudden he's shot with tracers, and I thought, Jesus, this guy's got guns in his nose. So I pulled up in front of him, which put me at a tactical disadvantage, straight up in the vertical. We were at about 10,000 feet. And I had my nose going up through 15,000 feet, looking, pulling back, pulling about 6 G's over the top. What I expected to see was him going straight through and running. Well, normally, even if somebody pulls up, you look back and the guy's about a mile and a half away from you, going up in the vertical with you. Well, as I look back, we were canopy to canopy, maybe 400 or 500 feet apart. By pulling up early, he went up right with me, and I looked back and I saw a set of little Gomer eyes, little Gomer goggles, little Gomer scarf, little Gomer mic that he had on here, and he just sitting there looking at me, going up in the vertical. Well, we climbed straight up like this, and being in a phantom, I out-zoomed him. And as I went over the top, I started pulling toward him, and he shot some BBs, 23 and 37 millimeter, just a squirt at him, to force me to turn. And when I turned, he rolling at my 6 o'clock, like this. Well, I thought, well, he's lucky, because nobody would give me any much trouble until then. It's pretty easy. Well, what I didn't realize was this was Colonel Toon, the leading MiG killer that they had. He had 13 kills to his credit, and he had been vectored after me, after Willie and myself. Well, I didn't know it at the time, and I thought, well, I'll get this guy. So I pulled into him, and as his nose dropped, I rolled in. He pulled into me with going nose low, which means he accelerates. Okay, I pitched my nose up over the top, rolled in behind his 6 o'clock. Okay, when he had his nose down, now, I could look, and I could just see him looking at me out the back of his airplane, looking out the side panel, watching. And as soon as I dropped my nose down, he pulled straight up in the vertical again. I overshot his flight path. He rolled up over the top, pulling right straight through to my 6 o'clock and rolled in behind me. Well, it was a series of those. It's what we call a rolling scissors in tactics. And a MiG-17, once you get slow, has got a big turn advantage on you. And as we got slow, he started eating me up. Well, I had been through the school and fighter weapons school and learned how to disengage. And this is where training is important. I had been in that situation in training before. and I knew exactly how to get out of it. At least I thought I had an idea of how to get out of it. I tried what I'd done in training, and it worked. When he got his nose just a little bit too high, he was sitting at my 7 o'clock, I pulled sharply down into him, met him head on, lit the burners, accelerated straight away, kicked so I could watch him come around, so he could come around the corner, and by the time he got his nose to me, I was a mile and a half out ahead of him, out of his range, opening. Got there, pitched back up into the vertical, we went into another vertical, canopy to canopy, going up, the same type thing. We got in a rolling scissors, he gained advantage on me again. I said, Jesus Christ, who is this guy? And none of the other drivers had been that aggressive. Well, disengaged from him the same way, started to go up and met him a third time head on. Okay, each time I'd gone up with this guy in the vertical, I had out-zoomed him or gone higher than he had, and every time I went out in front of him, he tried to shoot. And I figured, well, one time he's going to get lucky. So this time we're going up pretty much co-altitude, canopy to canopy, and I went to idle and selected my speed brakes. And I think it caught him by surprise because he shot way out in front of me now. But a Phantom sitting there on full afterburner, sitting at 150 knots, standing on your tail using thrust,